Natalia emerged from the stairwell onto the main level of the National Defense Building. Everywhere she looked, there was devastation. The main level of the building looked all but destroyed. Piles of rubble littered the marble floors. Columns lay toppled. The ceiling above her head groaned, ready to collapse, as she picked her way among the piles of debris and the dead. The pattern of the devastation eluded her until she reached the main entrance that led onto the central street of New Germany's capital. Black-clad elite corps shock troops controlled this segment of the city and were everywhere in considerable numbers. The main gates to the city, just barely visible to the naked eye from her vantage point, had been overrun. There was gunfire amidships now as John, Michael, and Paul climbed through the access tube toward the submarine science bay. The walls of the tube gleamed bright like burnished gold, but were merely stainless steel, or some modern equivalent, reflecting the beam of John's flashlight. He spotted a small hatchway ahead.
I think we're there.
What they would find there was uncertain. One man with a little skill, imagination, and the proper weapon could hold off 20 or more men trying to squeeze through the smallish access hatchways, merely picking them off one at a time. Rourke secured the flashlight. He pulled one of the Detonic Scoremasters with his right hand, put his left hand on the wheel lock, and turned.
Be ready. Damn!
Rourke had planned ahead. From one of the pouches on his belt, he took a tube of lubricant. Belting his pistol, he applied the lubricant liberally to the hub of the wheel. John parked the lubricant back in his pouch, drew his Scoremaster, and carefully tried the wheel. The wheel turned quick and quiet. As it neared the end of its rotation, Rourke gave it a hard twist, released it, then drew his second Scoremaster. The wheel stopped. The door opened slowly under Rourke's hand pressure, the second Scoremaster held loosely in his fingers. He peered out into the science labs. There was no one immediately in evidence. He swung his body around, got his feet through, then jumped, coming down in a crouch. The hammers of both Scoremasters rolled back under his thumbs. Behind him, he heard the sounds of Michael and Paul exiting the access tube. The compartment was long and narrow, quite clearly an interior corridor connecting sections of the science labs to each other with closed, watertight doors on either side. Rourke signaled Paul and Michael back as he approached the nearer of the two doors, the one on his right. He flattened himself against the interior bulkhead. He extended his right leg, then gently nudged his foot against the door. It held fast. Paul and Michael ran up, taking positions on either side of him. Rourke touched at the wheel of the watertight door, safed the Scoremaster, and slipped it into his belt. The wheel spun easily. Anyone on the other side of the doorway would realize the door was being opened, so there was no need for perfect silence. As soon as the lock cleared, Rourke redrew the .45 and kicked against the door, stepping back and right. Through the open doorway, he could see no one. Paul and Michael went through the doorway, Paul crossing left to right, Michael right to left. Rourke followed them, dodging right as he entered. The laboratory was deserted. At its far end was a winding metal staircase connecting, Rourke deduced, science to medical above.
Let's go.
Another missile would be striking the mountain at any second. The National Defense Headquarters would collapse, or at least partially so, and the three Soviet elite corpsmen who were Natalia's targets would run for their lives. She waited, although it was hard for her to do so. But Natalia waited for the whine of the incoming missile to be at its loudest. As the missile reached its crescendo, Natalia rose from her position of concealment behind an overturned transport, the Walther PPKS American, in both fists. The shot struck the farthest of the three elite corpsmen, killing him instantly, his body slapping forward. The shockwave drove Natalia to the ground. Huge slabs of building material crashed down. The street in front of her buckled up with the force of a water main rupturing. Natalia pushed herself to her feet and ran. She jumped the widening crack in the street and reached the smallest of the three dead men. Natalia grabbed his body by the collar of his BDUs and dragged him after her. At the height of the stairs, the medical complex was not on alert, and there were six med techs involved in day-to-day routines. Rourke came out of the stairwell and trained both Scoremasters on them.
Stay where you are, and you will not be hurt.
Six sets of arms raised at once. The most humane thing was to use one of the gas grenades.
Lie down in a comfortable position and breathe deeply.
Within seconds, all six were unconscious, and aside from colossal headaches, would be none the worse for wear when they awakened. Rourke went to a supply cabinet, found a large plastic bottle of Soviet acetaminophen tablets, then set it on one of the tables near where the six lay. Rourke looked at Paul, who was checking the German MP40. Michael was substituting 20-round magazines in his Beretta 92Fs. John shrugged his shoulders under the weight of the double Alessi shoulder rig's harness, then checked the little Centennial 38 he brought along. He picked up both Scoremasters, cocked and locked, from the table nearest him.
Gentlemen.
Ready?
Ready.
I'll get the door.
Paul broke into a jog trot across the medical complex toward the watertight door at the far end. Beyond it, there should be a companionway, likely guarded at the other end, because it led directly to the con at the heart of the command deck. The man's clothes fit Natalia well enough, but the dead elite corpsman's clothing, like her own, was soaked in the spray from the ruptured, still-spouting water main. Her wet hair, at last, satisfactorily stuffed under the elite corpsman's BDU cap, Natalia crawled out of the shadow of the pile of building rubble, the Soviet assault rifle in her hands. Fires burned around the city, she guessed, as the result of electrical disruption. Gray-blue trailers of synth fuel hung heavy on the air. The elite corps front line was now a ragged crescent, and after the last missile strike, small arms fire erupted between the German and Soviet units closest to each other. The German tanks held their line, and as yet, there was no Soviet armor rolling through the Soviet-held main entrance to the German capital. She saw only 5 machine gun emplacements on the Soviet side. This reinforced her opinion that the elite corps unit's commander decided to hit fast with light arms. Glancing toward the main entrance again, she could almost visualize their strike. Evidently, one or more of the missiles wiped out much of the German defense immediately outside the main entrance. While the Germans reorganized and with missile attack temporarily ceased, this Soviet unit, only a few hundred men at most, rushed in.
Idiot!
The sort of field commander who would send in that many men with so few heavy weapons to back them up against a fortified position such as this displayed total lack of concern for the lives of the men. What Natalia needed to do was reach one of the machine guns, preferably the most rearward of them, and hope that once she started using it, the Germans would counterattack if she could hold out long enough. She pulled the visor of her cap lower over her eyes. She looked down her front, making certain the purse she had stuffed in over her chest to disguise her figure was where it should be. That the material from which the black bag was made was also bullet-resistant was at least a little comforting. Holding the rifle in both hands, she ran forward in a low crouch to join the comrades attacking New Germany. Paul Rubinstein snapped 2 sound and light grenades down the companionway and pulled back. Rourke stabbed both Scoremasters around the corner. Michael fired both Berettas from shoulder level as he dodged into the companionway, then back. Paul emptied the submachine gun down the companionway. He made a fast change with the magazines and nodded. The men bolted into the companionway, ready for anything that moved. The only movement was the Rourke plan. The watertight door would be locked, and it made no sense to try it. Paul and Michael scrounged weapons from the dead, while John took the magnetic mine from the pack on his son's back and clamped it near the locking mechanism. Paul fed out the rope of plastique-like explosive, feeding it out of its protective tube as Michael molded the substance into the juncture of watertight door and flange. Gas sprayed from small jets where the bulkheads on either side of the companionway met the overhead. The gas was gray as fog and billowed down in thick clouds.
Ready! Now!
Michael and Paul raced back along the companionway and dove into a side corridor next to John. The 3-man army ran for the doorway, a jagged, smoking maw, firing their Soviet LMGs in controlled bursts. Rourke reached the twisted flange and jumped it, a Soviet rifle in each fist. Crew personnel lay everywhere, bodies twisted and torn. Small arms fire rained from the height of a circular stairwell just beyond the command chair. The Soviet commander lay dead in his seat. From the deck below, John heard a familiar voice.
Follow me!
Natalia rolled her disarmed grenade into the knot of elite corpsmen, surrounding the nearest Soviet machine gun placement.
Grenade! Run, comrades!
She ran, glancing back to see the men around her disperse in all directions. Natalia turned 180 degrees and threw herself into the machine gun bunker. She swung the machine gun online with the nearest knot of elite corpsmen and opened fire, spraying the machine gun across their position. She turned the muzzle of the machine gun, firing long bursts at every elite corps position within reach. She swept the hat back from her head, her hair cascading down, her right finger pressed against the machine gun's trigger.
Achtung! Attack! Attack!
Well, not in perfect condition, granted, but I think we can establish contact with the other 2 Island-class subs. Michael, why don't you?
Right.
Make sure to find out, Michael, which submarine may have our people in control and which may have a Soviet commander still at the helm.
Okay, Jason.
Darkwood merely shook his head. John watched him. Darkwood's face would have been amusing, just seeing how the man was trying to cope with a bridge crew of largely inept amateurs. Except the survival of New Germany and the Allied cause depended on whether or not he could get the island-class missiles turned against the Soviet land forces, while at the same time avoiding a battle with one or both submarines near them. Darkwood turned to Sam Aldridge.
How are we on weapon systems, Sam?
We got a full complement of cluster charges to port and starboard, and a full complement of torpedoes fore and aft. 19 missiles remaining. None of the warheads nuclear, as far as I can tell, Jace.
Very well. Adjust targeting to the last available coordinates for the Soviet land force. All of the missiles.
Yes, sir.
Han Luchen settled in at the sonar console.
As far as I could tell, Captain Darkwood, one of the Soviet undersea boats has turned around.
Coming about is the proper terminology, Mr. Han.
Jason, I've got confirmation that the island class nearest to us is in Allied hands. Evidently, the third team got stopped.
Darkwood looked down at his hands.
There were a lot of good men in that team. Shit. Mr. Rourke, if your Russian can manage it, signal the third vessel to surrender now. No terms except that their lives will be spared, period. Don't wait for a response. On the same frequency, signal sub number 2 to prepare to fire starboard side cluster charges on my command. The full complement, and prepare for firing torpedoes fore and aft at their discretion.
But will they know how?
Of course not. But the Russians won't know that.
I'm on it.
Darkwood turned to Paul Rubinstein at the engineering console.
Mr. Rubinstein, how's it coming getting some control over this little submarine we've inherited?
Paul crouched beneath the console.
I think I've got enough things wired together that we'll have full range of motion, Jason.
Darkwood nodded.
Very good, Mr. Rubinstein. Be ready to push the right buttons and pull the right switches when I indicate.
Darkwood turned to Michael Rourke again.
Repeat the command again for surrender. Don't wait for response. Make a big show of talking to Island Class Number 2 about releasing that full complement of starboard side cluster charges in the next 20 seconds. Then listen for Sub Number 3 to surrender, I hope.
He looked at Sam Aldridge.
Sam, you ready to fire some of those missiles at the Soviet ground force position?
Whenever you're ready.
Darkwood looked at John Rourke.
Doctor, do you have indicator lights showing that we're basically in one piece enough to fire a missile without ripping ourselves apart?
Rourke smiled.
I have green lights on all watertight doors linking major compartments.
He glanced at the weapon station, then looked back at Darkwood.
And fore and aft torpedo tubes all show to be sealed.
Darkwood looked at the watch on his left wrist.
Michael, any word from our Soviet neighbors?
Nothing yet. Hey, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm getting a message now from Number 3 that they are standing down.
Order them to cease all navigation at once and order our friends in Number 2 to keep those cluster charges ready to fire. Also, they should be prepared to fire torpedoes as necessary should Number 3 resume navigation.
Darkwood looked at Sam Aldridge.
Sam? Let's pound hell out of that Soviet land force. Fire those missiles, one every 60 seconds, until I say otherwise.
Aye, Captain.
John Rourke watched the engineering station. The submarine was holding together, if the readouts were correct. Germans swarmed toward Natalia's position. She stood up, throwing both hands in the air.
I am Major Timurovna! I am Major Timurovna! Do not shoot!
German long-range mountain patrol personnel formed a ring around her, faces startled, guns lowering. One man pushed through the squad.
Mein Gott! Fräulein Major, I salute you!
It was Colonel Mann, his usually impeccable uniform smoke-smudged, his hat gone, an assault rifle in his hands.
Missiles are striking Soviet positions where troops were massed for assault on the city. Three of my armored units are blocking entry to the city. The Soviet commanders can only withdraw toward the sea.
John...
Natalia sank to her knees, tears rimming her eyes. Rourke stood on the deck of the island-class submarine. Sea spray washed over her bow as he focused his binoculars toward the shore. J-7Vs crisscrossed the beach, and German helicopters swarmed out of the setting sun. All three island-class submarines were now in Allied hands. Jason Darkwood commanding and essentially navigating all three from the con of this one on which John Rourke stood. The submarine, renamed the Freedom, was now unofficially the first vessel in an Allied Navy. Soviet land force units not already destroyed by conventionally armed missiles fired from the Freedom were withdrawing under the pressure of German armor and air power to the sea. They would have no choice but to surrender or die. Rourke turned up the collar of his borrowed coat, the binoculars hanging now from his neck. Radio transmissions from the mountain city indicated that Sarah, Annie, and Maria, as well as the other women in the leader bunker, were alive and well, despite the destruction of the Naval Defense Headquarters building above the bunker. Evacuation was underway. Natalia rode with Colonel Mann, who personally commanded his forces as they pressed the Germans toward the sea. Soon, all three island-class submarines would depart for the Soviet underwater city to aid in blocking Soviet nuclear retaliation. Already, mid-wake vessels, the Reagan, the Wayne, the captured island-class submarine Roy Rogers, and others circled the Soviet enclave, attempting to stall their forces until the Allies launched their counterattack. That would be within days, a two-pronged strike against both the underwater Soviet complex and the heart of Soviet power in the Urals. The dual assault would end this war, one way or the other. Though a few skirmishes broke out, the majority of the Soviet land force surrendered without significant resistance when faced with German air power above, German troops on the ground behind them, and the captured Soviet island-class submarines along the shore. Now, John and Paul stood on a grassy slope overlooking a level area about the size of 10 football fields. Some 50 yards below them, 12 people, including Michael and Natalia, lifted devices each about the size and shape of a US M60 machine gun from the days before the night of the war. All of the objects were hand-built. Cost, Rourke mused, had to have been enormous, but under the circumstances, academic. In all, there were 24 of the rather unwieldy shoulder-fired energy weapons, each powered by a backpack unit which, with John Rourke's limited knowledge of physics, seemed to closely approach the idea of harnessing naturally occurring plasma energy, as seen in ordinary lightning and ball lightning. There was a certain irony to this that escaped neither Rourke nor his friend Paul Rubinstein as they watched this second round of field testing.
It's interesting to see Michael firing that weapon, isn't it, John? Lightning harnessed in his hands. Yet it was lightning-like energy as a result of the ionization effect, which nearly destroyed his world 5 centuries ago.
By plasma energy, mankind was nearly undone. Now, by plasma energy, mankind may yet be saved.
Based on the original Soviet particle beam technology developed in the years before the night of the war, but never fully implemented, plasma energy was initially used to accelerate particles. But with this current technology, the plasma energy itself became the weapon. The weapon system was based on the theory of the glow discharge, the inverse of the principle used in magneto-hydrodynamic power generation. Beams of energy, in relation to the square of a magnetic field, occurred by pulsing the magnetic field. The glow discharge occurred between two electrodes. During the Great Conflagration, high amounts of plasma energy from enormously powerful currents in the ionized atmosphere all but destroyed the planet. This glow discharge system used a comparatively minimal current, producing a controlled degree of ionization, a rather imaginative application of Landau damping controlled wave amplitude. The result was a gun that discharged energy, rather like the Greek god Zeus hurling lightning bolts. Within months, at an accelerated rate of development, the power supply pack would be miniaturized, and rather than the ungainly shoulder-fired weapons ready for testing in this deserted field outside the German mountain city, there would be hand and shoulder weapons as convenient as cartridges in the high-capacity 9mm pistols and 5.56mm assault rifles in use 5 centuries ago. Michael raised his weapon and took aim on a man-sized silhouette some 200 meters distant. There was a laser sighting device mounted to the energy weapon. If the operator could settle the laser beam on the target clearly enough to be seen, the operator could hit the target. In bright light, as was the case now, the operator used an optical sight built into the carrying handle. Michael leaned into the weapon and fired. A lightning bolt, pale blue in color and almost blindingly bright, discharged from the weapon's muzzle, striking the target.
Welcome to the future.
Yes, but ours.
John jerked his head inland, toward the next valley that held the Soviet prison camps until this war reached its conclusion. Just what that conclusion might be, who would win, was subject to so many variables that a scenario for its outcome was not clear. If the Soviets launched nuclear weapons from their enclave beneath the Pacific, there would be no world remaining at all. Rourke stared at the water, thousands of feet below the J-7V in which he rode. It was the wrong ocean, of course, the Atlantic rather than the Pacific, but he could imagine Jason Darkwood piloting the new Allied fleet of commandeered Soviet island-class submarines toward a rendezvous in the Pacific with the men of Midwake. John's affairs took him elsewhere. Jason Darkwood and the United States Marines of Midwake, plus a core group of Allied commandos, would assault the Soviet underwater facility in the Pacific to prevent the launch of Soviet nuclear weapons in support of Soviet land forces headquartered in the underground city in the Urals. The Ural Mountains of Soviet Europe were John Rourke's destination. First, a strike at Antonovich's field HQ near where, 5 centuries ago, the Volga River met the Caspian Sea. The night of the war, bombings altered the course of the Volga. The entire area from the dry bed of the Volga to the still-flowing Ural River lay barren, an icy desert. The Soviet Union built its greatest airfield there, along with its largest concentration of personnel and equipment outside of the underground city itself. Guriev now housed the armies once commanded by Natalia's deceased husband, Vladimir Karamazov, the KGB elite corps. In addition, Guriev forces included 5 armored battalions and 2 armored missile battalions. With Guriev, there was no hope to counter the Soviet war machine. Without Guriev, there was a chance. 24 operational plasma energy weapons against how many dozens or hundreds, perhaps? John looked away from the water, studying the charts on the screen of the German tablet computer. There was no other way than the way he decided when first presented with the tactical difficulties involved. John closed his eyes. They sat around a long, rectangular folding table. Natalia studied the faces. Wolfgang Mann looked tired, spread too thin, much like the nation of New Germany he served. Paul looked almost eager to be underway. Like her, with 5 centuries of warfare coming to a close, the prospect of peace, regardless of the dangers they faced securing it, was so tantalizing. She looked away as Paul looked up, though they exchanged the briefest of smiles. Natalia looked at Michael across the table. How like his father he seemed, growing more like John every day, and not just in looks. Michael had his father's eyes, the high forehead and healthy shock of brown hair, the lined, lean face. John. He seemed unchanged from when she saw him that very first time in Latin America, when he was still active CIA. That very first time, he wore a white dinner jacket, looking ridiculously handsome. In the West Texas desert, he wore a light blue chambray shirt and faded jeans. Now he dressed in black, black knit shirt, black BDU pants, black lace-up-the-front boots. John rose to speak, and the eyes of every man in the room, she was the only woman, settled on him. They were tough men, hardened fighters, German long-range mountain patrol commanders, German commandos like Otto Hammerschmidt, men like 1st Chinese City Intelligence Commando Han Lu Chen, and Icelandic policeman Bjorn Rolvag.
A portion of our force, under the command of United States Marine Captain Sam Aldridge, will attack Guriev from the northern shore of the Caspian as a separate element. But that attack will not commence until our job at the base is complete. When Aldridge and his force of midwake Marines hit, they'll knock out the anti-aircraft emplacements along the shore itself. Our task is twofold. Major Chemerovna, Paul Rubinstein, my son Michael and I will penetrate the base itself. Meanwhile, Captain Otto Hammerschmidt... Oh, I'm sorry. Major Hammerschmidt.
John nodded deferentially toward the recently promoted Otto Hammerschmidt.
Major Hammerschmidt and Mr. Hahn, meanwhile, with the assistance of Officer Rolvag, will lead an attack against the second of the 2 primary anti-aircraft facilities, this to the north of the Guriev base. Their task will be relatively similar to that of Captain Aldridge, to knock out the anti-aircraft defenses so that after Natalia, Paul, Michael, and I have done our work, German paratroops can hit the main portion of the base itself, under the command of Major Hartmann, also recently promoted.
Again, John nodded, this time at Hartmann, de facto field commander for the German forces in Europe.
As Major Hartmann's personnel strike, Colonel Mann will personally lead a force of J-7Vs and helicopters against the base. Just as important as knocking out the anti-aircraft facilities is preventing as many Soviet aircraft as possible from scrambling airborne. That's the task Natalia, Michael, Paul, and I will undertake. From the Soviet prisoners taken during the fighting in New Germany, we've been able to assemble uniforms. Using Soviet IDs and orders, technicians in New Germany produced identical, duplicate identification and cut new orders that will cover the 4 of us getting into the base, we hope. Once into the base, we'll proceed to the airfield.
John reached into a musette bag on the table in front of him. He pulled out what looked like a jewelry box. Opening it, he removed what appeared to be an ordinary Soviet-issue military wristwatch.
Each of the 4 of us will have one of these in the event we are separated or something else keeps us from functioning together as a unit. Once again, we can thank German technological ingenuity.
John nodded toward Colonel Mann.
These are Soviet wristwatches on the outside, and like their more normal counterparts, they do tell time. They indicate temperature, barometric pressure, and background radiation readings, too. Unlike the actual issue watches, however, each of these is equipped with a one-time-only-use radio-transmitting device. The band itself looks synthetic, like those used on the Soviet issue watch, but is, rather, a metal alloy. It will serve as a projection antenna for the radio signaling device that is actuated by pulling the stem out past the set position and then winding it.
There were blank looks on the faces of everyone in the room, except for Paul and Michael.
Now, in the days prior to batteries, watches used a tightening spring to power the movement. My watch, for example, is what was called self-winding. Merely picking up a Rolex once a day keeps it running. More basic watches required winding at least once every 24 hours. The stem of the watch, as the Soviets use here merely for setting, had to be turned back and forth or wound until spring tension grew so tight the stem couldn't turn further without forcing it. We will wind the watch until it achieves maximum tension. When that tension releases, the radio signal fires. That signal, from Natalia or Michael's or Paul or my Soviet watch, will alert Colonel Mann's forces. At that time, a drone J-7V will overfly Guriev Field and bomb it. The drone will be shot down, most likely. Whether it is or isn't, the resultant distraction should provide cover for us to reach our primary objective with the explosives we'll be carrying. Then, we have to blow up a bunch of aircraft.
How will you escape the base, Doctor?
We will take up the best defensive position available and wait it out until Major Hartman's paratroopers reach the field. We will don armbands, blaze orange, to distinguish us from enemy personnel. If all goes even moderately well, we neutralize Guriev base and move on to the underground city for a coordinated strike time to coincide with Midway's submarine and commando attack on the Soviet underwater complex in the Pacific.
Natalia looked around the tent. The moment she'd been waiting for so long was nearly at hand. This sole obstacle, Guriev, was all that remained before a final confrontation that would end it one way or the other. She was suddenly very lonely. However this turned out, whether she lay dead in some anonymous mass grave or survived to be free, to be alone was her destiny. John wore the uniform of a major of the KGB Elite Corps. To disguise his appearance, he shaved away most of his sideburns. Anticipating such a penetration into the Soviet sphere of influence, he let his mustache grow for 2 weeks. Now grown and a little gray, it served to draw his features down, making his already naturally long face seem that much longer. Beside John, the only one of the four of them wearing appropriate rank, sat Natalia. She dressed as a female major of the KGB Elite Corps, a rank she once held, the KGB at least. Despite the severity of the uniform, knee-length black A-line skirt, heavy stockings, and sensible shoes under an open ankle-length greatcoat, she looked exquisite, as was normal for her in any event. She covered her almost black hair with a blonde wig, considerably shorter than her own hair beneath it, so short it was almost the length of a man's hair. In the front seat of the Soviet ATV staff car, on the driver's side, Paul wore a senior sergeant's uniform. Beside him, hair dyed blonde and fake mustache added to divert the casual observer from the obvious physical similarities between son and father, sat Michael, uniformed as a lieutenant. Paul slowed the ATV to take a deliberate right turn onto the roadway leading toward the main gate. John checked under his uniform blouse. With some skillful tailoring by quartermaster personnel at New Germany, he was able to conceal his twin stainless Titanics combat masters and the double Alessi shoulder rig, a suppressor-fitted 6906 in a specially designed inner pocket of his greatcoat, and the two scoremasters in his belt. He carried the little Centennial in the outside pocket of his greatcoat, ideal for that application because the hammer was completely enclosed, and there was absolutely nothing to foul in the pocket lining if he fired the gun. Rourke smiled as he remembered the words of his old friend, master gunsmith and consummate martial artist Ron Mahovsky, concerning his lifelong addiction to the revolver. Six for sure. The Centennial was only five for sure, but the principle was the same.
We're gonna be stopping in a minute or so for the first gate check.
Remember the Soviet communist mindset. There is a terrifying, often paralyzing fear of authority. Authority is the father figure. And with such a father figure, there is always the risk of being disciplined. If we establish ourselves instantly as authority figures with which to be dealt and of which to be afraid, we can ride in easily using our cover identities and altered appearances.
Once we're inside, no matter what happens, One of us has to get to the airfield. If we can't sabotage enough aircraft, then we blow the synth fuel dump. At least that'll keep them from making too many sorties and tie up a lot of their ground personnel.
If we can make it through the gates, we can make it to the airfield.
Rourke caught his son's eyes in the rearview mirror.
I'm glad you're so confident.
The ATV slowed. Heavily armed sentries stood on either side of the roadway, deflection barriers behind them. Sandbagged machine gun nests flanked the road on the outer side of the first segment of the security gauntlet and beyond the deflection barriers, between the outer and inner guard stations. The gates themselves were made of solid metal, titanium, Rourke guessed, 12 feet high, topped for another 2 feet above by barbed wire. John assumed the wire would be electrified when the gates closed to make the contact. The gates stayed closed now as the guard sergeant approached the staff ATV, saluting as Paul lowered the window and Michael produced the orders. The sergeant said not a word, merely inspected the orders. Natalia rolled down her window and flicked ashes from her cigarette toward the ground. She spoke to Rourke as though picking up a conversation in midstream.
I disagree that the Germans have any sort of chance against us, comrade.
Yes, comrade Major, but as much as I agree and believe in the superiority of our forces, the fact remains that the German war machine, augmented as it is by the Americans and other allies, is too strong to be ignored.
But too weak to be a threat.
Natalia looked at him with indifference.
Yes.
Comrade Major, it is necessary to see...
Papers.
She reached into her purse and shoved the ID toward him through the open window.
We are in a great hurry.
She looked away, snapping her cigarette out the window toward the guard sergeant's feet. Rourke handed across his papers, as did Michael and Paul.
Be quick about this, Sergeant. There will be difficulties.
The already slightly nervous-looking guard sergeant's eyes widened a little as he returned Natalia's papers.
Thank you, Comrade Major.
He saluted as he spoke. Then the guard sergeant passed back John Rourke's papers.
You may be right that I have expressed too much caution, comrade. But to be cautious is better than to be reckless.
I grant you that, comrade.
The guard returned Michael's and Paul's papers, and the deflection barricade before them slowly lowered. Paul drove on. John released his grip on the Smith & Wesson Centennial inside the pocket of his greatcoat. 5 for sure. An ice-edged wind blew across the parade ground fronting the airfield at Guriev. The ice field extended in all directions as far as John Rourke could see. Far to the west was the Ural River, all but an ice-encrusted channel. The four stood, surveying the field and their options.
Boy, it's cold.
Try bare legs except for these miserable nylons.
The four of them walked to the front of the staff ATV. Warmth radiated from the idling engine, rising in visible waves off the low, armor-plated hood. John stared toward the gates leading onto the field. Security here was less in evidence, but it was a given that the base would be on full alert after the debacle the Soviets suffered in New Germany. A few yards from the entrance to the field stood a sign. The notice read, "Only service vehicles beyond this point." There was a low fence of chain link surrounding the field. Beyond the fence, and snowdrifts and massive chunks of upthrusting ice, lay the runways. To the west, nearer to the riverside, stood hangars, a tower, and the administrative buildings, all prefabricated structures and all of considerable size.
Those cars on the other side of the deflection barrier passed a guard poster, evidently to take visiting personnel to their destinations, then return them to the parking area. Any large amount of explosives from reaching the field.
I thought you were overestimating the difficulty level.
If you noticed, as I did, when we parked before the inner guard post by the main entrance, there was a pressure plate under us. Likely the car was scanned for explosives.
Our guns, too?
No. The machine wouldn't be sensitive to firearms or sensitive enough to detect explosives carried on our persons. Otherwise, it would register an alarm every time a vehicle passed. If we carried explosives loaded in the ATV, we would have betrayed ourselves.
I think we better get about our business. Remember, no guns until the last possible second. And if it's a shooting situation, let's try our best for Natalia to handle it with her suppressed weapon or for me to do it with mine, right? Let's go.
They walked toward the airfield gates across the frozen field in twos. The guards evidently noticed them. Three officers and a senior non-com drew themselves to attention, and the guard sergeant made a rifle salute.
Comrade Major.
Sergeant, we will require transportation to the main hangar area at once.
Rourke handed over his identity papers and turned to Paul.
Sergeant Kerensky, the orders.
Yes, Comrade Major.
The guard sergeant took the orders after returning John Rourke's identity papers. The other three produced their papers.
Forgive me, Comrade Major, but there is heightened security now, and I must confirm these orders with Captain Mikhailovich, who is the officer of the guard.
As John suspected, the ordinary Soviet soldier didn't know of the debacle in New Germany, or else the guard sergeant's remarks would have at least hinted at the reason.
Very well, Sergeant, but see to it at once.
John caught the look of trepidation in his son's eyes. He turned away from his son to Natalia.
Comrade, while we wait here, allow me to inspect once again that curious object we discussed a moment ago.
Natalia smiled up at him. Her lips came together briefly, as though blowing him a kiss. She opened her purse as John Rourke reached into the reinforced interior pocket of his greatcoat. Natalia's suppressor-fitted Walther PPKS came from her shoulder bag at the same moment Rourke drew the suppressor-fitted Smith & Wesson 6906.
We should have no more than 10 minutes, probably less. Someone will find the bodies in the guard post soon.
Rourke nodded. He focused on the larger of the two hangars.
German intelligence overflights indicate that largest hangar over there contains the helicopter gunships plus some sort of fuel supply. The main fuel dumps are behind us to the east. The other hangar holds fighter bombers. Michael, you get into the tower facility and kill everyone there. Then disable every piece of equipment you can find.
John gave his son the silenced 6906.
You have 5 pounds of German plastique on you. Break off half, give it to Natalia. You won't need it all for the tower job.
Right.
Paul, you take the hangar with the fighter bombers. Get in, plant your plastique, and get out. Meet Michael near the tower, then get to the vehicle here and drive to those bunkers over there. You see them?
They were anti-aircraft troops' bunkers built to the far southern edge of the airfield.
Then what?
Sandbag yourself in and wait for reinforcements. But before that, Michael, when you're about to enter the tower, and Paul, as you're about to enter the fighter bomber hangar, activate the signals on your wristwatches to call in the J-7B drone. That should lend enough confusion to the situation to mask your escapes and help us do the same. Then, the paratroopers come in the German air power, and everything's rosy.
Natalia and John walked across the hangar. As she walked, she opened the buttons of her greatcoat. John's coat was already open, his right hand inside the outer pocket. The hangar was enormous. In staggered ranks of four, files 25 deep or better stood fully equipped, apparently battle-ready Soviet gunships in greater abundance than she had ever seen before. She wished, suddenly, they could have brought at least one of the new energy weapons, because the helicopters were so equipped. But, except for what they could carry on their bodies, the risks of detection were too great, and the energy weapons were too large and unwieldy to carry. Several officers in black battle dress utilities stood around a large synth fuel stove. John walked toward them. It would start here, Natalia knew, because the hangar was too open to plant 7.5 pounds of explosives in several different locations without being spotted. Natalia pretended to fumble in her purse so she could reach the Walther quickly enough. As they approached the Elite Corps officers, one of them noticed the two senior officers approaching.
Oh, attention!
John and Natalia came to a stop.
As you were, comrades. What an excellent facility.
Thank you, Comrade Major. We are very proud of our humble part in the defense of the Soviet.
As well you should be.
Thank you, Comrade.
You seem quite enthused. Tell me, Comrade, how long have you been stationed here?
2 years, Comrade Major. But I am particularly pleased to be back among my friends, working for the people.
Ah, where have you been, Captain?
I recently returned to duty after giving birth to my second child. Hopefully, one day, he and his sister will follow my late husband and me into the service.
A noble desire, Captain.
Though right now, his sister just wants to dance. How might we assist you, Comrade Major?
Ah, yes. You might assist us indeed. In light of recent events in the battle against the new imperialism, it has come to the attention of the Premier, whose office I have but recently left, that there is the increased possibility of sabotage by Allied agents against the Soviet people. The Comrade Major who accompanies me is an expert in such matters. If you might indicate to her where the three most likely places would be that enemy agents might plant explosives in order to perpetrate the greatest harm to this facility, our work here would be vastly easier, comrade.
Certainly, Comrade Major. But may I ask,
3 locations. Why?
We know for a fact, comrade, that a group of Allied agents is active in this immediate vicinity even as we speak. We even know the amount and type of explosives they carry. The explosives are plastique in the quantity of slightly over 15 kilograms.
Comrade Major, should that quantity of explosives be used against this facility, it could wreak almost total destruction.
And that is most certainly their intention, comrade, preparatory to an assault on this entire facility. The 3 most potentially damaging locations, if you would, comrade, as quickly as possible, since there is not a moment to lose. And since I have taken you into our confidence, disclosing the amount of explosives to be used, it might further facilitate our work if you might suggest to the Comrade Major how the 15 kilograms might best be employed as concerns their most effective use.
Yes, Comrade Major.
There was such a tone of concern to the young captain's voice that Natalia almost felt ashamed of John for taking advantage of the young officer and mother. The captain turned to her and bowed slightly.
Comrade Major, if you would accompany me.
Thank you, Comrade.
The other officers fell in a few steps behind them as the captain took them across the hangar, between 2 of the ranks of gunships and toward a doorway. The sign on the door indicated explosives lay stored on the other side.
Tell me, comrade, what type of explosives are there here? How are they stored?
Missiles, Comrade Major, for use with our gunships in combat.
I see. And are they armed?
Oh, certainly not, comrade. But to facilitate their replacement, when many sorties must be flown in rapid succession, the detonators are stored in the same room.
Highly susceptible to sabotage. You have done well to show this to me. Would you say that the fuel storage area on the opposite side of the hangar is another likely spot for the saboteurs to plant their explosives?
Indeed, Comrade Major. If I may be so bold, I study the use of explosives in my off hours.
The young officer smiled.
That is, I study between diaper changes. Were I one of these Allied saboteurs, I would merely divide the 15 kilograms, 5 kilograms here and 10 there, by the fuel. The resultant explosions would wash the entire structure in flaming synth fuel and collapse the main support walls, destroying everything and everyone inside.
Natalia looked at John as the officer spoke.
I believe that is all we need to know, comrade.
John moved his left hand toward the buttons of the uniform blouse he wore beneath his greatcoat. Natalia looked at the young captain.
Comrade, I wish your most honest answer to this next question.
Yes, Comrade Major.
If you were given the opportunity to save your own life and return to your children while your comrades died, would you take it?
She looked positively hurt and deeply conflicted. Natalia felt very sorry for the sincere young woman.
Comrade Major, I assure you that I would never...
Natalia smiled her best smile as her right hand came out of her purse. Her fingers closed around the butt of the Walter.
You are a true credit to the officer corps of the Soviet Union, and I am sure someday would have earned with great honor the Order of Lenin.
John walked across the hangar floor, a scoremaster in each hand. He looked back once and saw Natalia on her knees, her suppressor-fitted Walter beside her, just inside the doorway of the storage shelter for the gunship's missiles. She set the first of the 2 explosive charges. In the distance, in this few seconds lull before the shooting started again, he could hear the sound of the drone J-7V coming in across the airfield to strike. With any luck, the Aldridge and Hammerschmidt teams were knocking out the 2 anti-aircraft batteries, and Paul and Michael were nearly through with their demolitions work. A senior sergeant with an assault rifle in his hands ran toward Rourke from the far side of the hangar.
Saboteurs, sergeant!
As if on cue, men streamed toward John from the rear of the hangar, armed with pistols, crowbars, and large wrenches. As the first wave neared, John Rourke raised both scoremasters to shoulder level. John kept walking as he stashed the empty scoremasters in his belt and pulled the combat masters from the double Alessi shoulder rig. Out of the far right corner of his peripheral vision, John could see Natalia running across the width of the hangar toward the fuel storage area. Rourke continued walking toward the leading rank of Soviet gunships.
Killing's gonna stop soon, one way or the other.
John parked the pistol in his right hand into his waistband for a moment, cocked and locked, grabbed one of the scoremasters and reloaded, just as a soldier ran at him, a wrench in his hand. Rourke quickly reloaded the second scoremaster as he approached the forwardmost rank of gunships. Two men charged him, both of them firing handguns. A bullet tore through the skirt of Rourke's greatcoat. Rourke walked along the forwardmost rank of gunships. An elite corpsman with a pistol stepped out. There were explosions outside now, a heavy volume of machine gun fire, but no sounds of anti-aircraft batteries opening up on the drone. Rourke saved both scoremasters as he climbed up into one of the gunships. The aircraft was empty. He sat down in the cockpit, put the pistols between his legs, muzzles against the seat surface, and activated the electrical systems. He scanned the floor of the hangar. Near the fuel storage area, Natalia was almost finished. Rourke looked over the instrument panel. All systems on, fuel gauges registered full. He started the main rotor. Oil pressure began to build as he flipped the switch for the tail rotor. Natalia ran from the fuel storage area looking for him. Rourke climbed out of the cockpit, guns in hand again, and went to the fuselage doorway on the starboard side.
Natalia, here, changing plans.
She waved to him and ran. John Rourke checked to port and starboard of the gunship. If men still lived inside here, they were holding back. He went forward, dropping down into the pilot seat again. Nearly full pressure, nearly sufficient RPMs. Through the hangar doors, he could see activity on the airfield outside, moving vehicles, running men, and battle chaos. He heard Natalia behind him.
Anything I need to do?
I don't think we're lashed down, but double check.
In an instant, she was back.
We have about 2 minutes.
Then we better get going. Strap in, Natalia.
She took the seat beside him. Rourke increased rotation, starting to lift off ever so slightly.
Oh, I hate this flying inside a building.
John very gently altered rotor pitch. The gunship edged forward over the floor.
Check that our weapon systems are all operational and give me machine guns.
Right. About 90 seconds, John, and the whole building goes.
Right.
Men were running into the hangar through the large doors. About a dozen took up positions behind parts, crates, and other gunships, shouldering their assault rifles.
We have machine guns up, Natalia?
Yes.
John flipped his control switches, activating forward firing, port, and starboard.
Missiles up?
Yes, we have 43 seconds, John.
Right.
Rourke let the gunship turn 90 degrees on the axis of the main rotor, activating a single starboard side missile, rotating away from it and increasing speed. The missile explosion rocked the building's walls. A fireball belched after them as Rourke looked back once and increased speed to escape it.
When we get outside, look for Paul and for Michael. If we can pick them up, they'll be safer.
All right. 21 seconds, John.
John gunned the main rotor, aiming the aircraft for the door. It dipped, slipping right in the sudden draft. Rourke radically altered main rotor pitch, and the gunship escaped the open hangar doors. The gunship climbed. John let it rotate 180 degrees and looked back. Secondary and tertiary explosions ripped through the hangar structure. The walls of the immense prefab building bulged out, then collapsed in as the roof fell and fireballs rushed up into the freezing air.
I see Michael!
Rourke looked to his left, banked the chopper to port, and started to descend, skimming over the runway. He saw Paul just ahead of Michael, both of them running toward the bunkers at the far end of the field. The control tower erupted, teetered like a chopped-through tree, and fell forward onto the airfield in a final blast. To Rourke's right, the roof of the jet hangar seemed to ripple front to back. Then a fireball tore through its center, belching skyward in the hot updraft. Rourke swooped down, providing covering fire for Paul and Michael. Behind him, in the distance, J-7Bs approached from the west, over the Ural River. He looked forward.
Fair job, the Germans!
Natalia switched signals to the German frequency.
This is Soviet gunship, KHR-333-658, piloted by John Rourke. This is Major Tiamarovna speaking. We are moving directly toward German helicopter force, flying east over center of field to pick up Michael Rourke and Paul Rubinstein. Hold your fire against us. I repeat, this is Major Tiamarovna in gunship.
He nearly had them. Michael and Paul were running toward them to intercept their line of flight.
Coming in!
John slipped the machine to starboard, cut back on main rotor power, pitched down, then settled to a landing. Paul and Michael vaulted inside as John Rourke looked back.
Take her up!
Rourke changed pitch, added power, and the gunship arced up. John turned the ship a full 360 degrees, then gave full power to the main rotor as he banked to port toward the German gunship force.
John, they see us! They are telling us to climb! Both the shore and inland batteries are destroyed with minimal casualties. We have them! We have them! I could kiss you!
John Rourke looked at Natalia Tiamarovna. As the gunship climbed, a grim smile creased his face. Another skirmish won, and the final battle close at hand. Survivalist to End All War is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1990, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, M.B. Van Dorn, Dylan Lynch, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Wren Casey, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Elizabeth Demery, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Penny, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Johann Detweiler, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Ken Jackson. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. With original music by Nathaniel Perry, Dan Smith, and Matt Webb. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Edge of the Seat thriller in Graphic Audio.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midalis, and you, Chieftain Bruinhelda, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. Not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills, and a test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, Elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Tuelalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the Folk of God! But you're just a pack of scared dogs, you are!
Join with us before all the world is fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth. And we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangere will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangere and all the masters of St. Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhawk, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in Graphic Audio.
Don't miss Mortalis Part 2. Available now.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.